also don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 341, and it's another day under the Arrakis sun. It's your host, Sifi Wadiwe, and in the booth with me are my friends, so let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, an esteemed and wonderful movie critic, and if you don't like his takes, fight me. It is Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
I'll tell you, what's good is that Mark Harris has been doing some really great culture beat writing at the New York Times, which, of course, he does. He is the king of this stuff. He had a recent piece about where even is the film industry going now in terms of, you know, where we are in the era of streaming and trying to get theaters back into a pre-COVID place, and really sort of digging into the nuts and bolts of what does the industry look like? Are we on the poise of a big change? Are we in a place where the studios were like in the late 60s where nobody wants to come see our mega musicals, but now we're going to like make, you know, Chinatown instead? Like, I don't know. It raised a lot of really provocative questions. And then today, the day that we're recording this, he dropped a new piece called Missing the Gay Best Friend. And it's a sort of a history of the gay best friend trope in movies and TV and how it sort of burned brightly and then went away because now we're all the star of our own story and we're not here to be anybody's sidekick. But, you know, he still kind of misses the GBF, and he's not wrong. And anyway, it's a fun piece. I will never be Mark Harris, but I can always tell people, hey, go read Mark Harris. He's great. So that's what I'm doing.
You don't need to be Mark Harris, hon. You are just good as you are.
I know.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We love our Alonzo Duralde. We don't want
Alonzo's the star of his own story.
That's right. I'm my own GBF.
Yes, exactly. But my MWBF, Queen of the Midwest, is none other than super producer programmer Drea Clark. What's good? And that stands for Midwest Best Friend.
My mind was racing, but okay.
I was like, married white? One of those is right. Speaking of the Midwest, I'm sure you guys were aware of this, but of course, the Minnesota State Hockey Championships were last week. My beloved White Bear Bears made it to the state tournament by defeating our rivals, Hill Murray. Eat it, Hill Murray. And then all good times stopped because for the 20th time, 20 years worth of this, since the very first state tournament in 1945, the White Bear Bears lost by 1 point in the first round of the quarterfinals. Mm. And I can't tell you, I do not care about sports. I certainly do not follow high school sports, but the quickness in which I can get talked back into caring about the White Bear Lake Bears hockey team is concerning to me. And did I look at pictures of my buddies Marsh and Lammers? Joe Elias was at the game. Jubba was watching. All of the favorites. And then all of it was capped by, I got a text the next day from our former producer, Casey O'Brien.
Oh, no, he's an enemy now. He's an eye.
Yeah,
so no, he's former beloved.
He's back full to, kick rock. He moved back to Minnesota, and he was like, you probably don't know or care, but the Bears, and I was like, let me stop you there. I somehow both know and care. And so we talked hockey. I talked hockey with Casey, who is a brand new father as well. So my what's good is not us losing in the tournament, except we're very proud of them for getting there. But Casey is a papa. So full circle.
Mazel tov. Is this a clutch issue? Like when the pressure's on, suddenly the Bears just fold or what?
This game was so ridiculous, Alonzo. They were down. We played Grand Rapids. Now I hate Grand Rapids, which is a bummer. I never, I'm losing states or cities to hate. And Grand Rapids pulled one up almost right away. Whole game. Hockey also the most boring. Like the lowest scores. It's so stupid. And so it was 1-0 the whole game. With a minute and a half to go, the Bears tied. And then it was like, oh, thrilling, because if it's a tie, it's a whole thing. I don't care. And then Grand Rapids scored again, like, with less than a minute to go. And then it was just pandemonium and upset. So stupid. Freaking hockey.
Well, yeah, it's so funny because I've recently gotten into hockey.
Oh, my God, that's
following,
right.
Following my Kings. And it is funny because the way the rules work there, even in the standings, because you get points. So if they make it into overtime, both teams get a point. And so the standings are wild because you'll have a team that has more wins but isn't at the top because there's a team with technically less losses and more overtime. So it's really it can be hard to track, but I've been supplementing, you know, watching the games with also going to play the NHL game and learn the rules by doing everything wrong. So,
so that's like, no one told me there would be math.
We call that the Pee Wee League. Welcome. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know, speaking of hockey, there's lots of times that, you know, you see people come in and out, whether they called up from the AHL or they're, you know, traded in. And much like that, we have great guests who takes us all the way to the Stanley Cup, which is the end of our episode. And today is no different. It is actor, writer, and co-host of the new Max Fun podcast, your evangelist, Jeremy Bent. What is good?
Woo! Well, yay! You know, thank you so much. It's interesting you brought up the NHL game. I have been getting in a little time on a game of my own called Helldivers 2.
Ooh, baby, I'm in there.
You know,
for democracy.
Yeah, right. It's interesting because it has a pretty strong film connection. They seem to have gotten most of their inspiration from the 1997 Starship Troopers. Mm-hmm. It's very like, amazing. We're going to go kill a bunch of aliens in the name of democracy. And it's very sort of tongue in cheek the whole time. But it's maybe the most fun I've had with like a group of my friends in an online game in a long time. The very first time we were playing, you're sort of like wandering around a planet. We're like, okay, we got to kill this like nest of big bugs. And at one point we walked by a bomb that was not exploded. It was just like in the ground. It was just a feature yes. of the game. And I was like, oh, I wonder, because sometimes there's like side objectives. And you're like, oh, maybe I can defuse this. And I was like, oh, I guess not. And so we just kept walking. And I was like, oh, maybe you're supposed to shoot it. And so I shot the bomb and I killed everyone in the game. We immediately like redropped and came right back. But I was like, oh, yeah, you shouldn't shoot an atomic bomb. That's a fact. That's just don't do that. But I was like, no, I got this.
That's fantastic.
But we all laughed like maniacs when that happened. So well, I'm having a good time.
It's so funny. I was just, you know, explaining this game to them a couple episodes ago.
Oh, no kidding.
And I have been seeing the trend of people finding out that the hell bomb, shooting it causes this huge explosion. But I'm just going to say my reaction was always to leave it alone. I was like, oh, a rogue bomb. just in a field.
No, I'm like, this has to be something. This is something we need to interact with. I'm going to knock on this until something happens.
Yeah,
let me hit it real hard. No one's going to tell me I can't shoot that thing.
This bomb deserves to be free.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, everything about that game has been fun. You know, reviving the Starship Troopers discourse. And someone like has broken down, like, because everyone has been like, the game isn't satire. But someone has paid attention to the lore and the illegal broadcast that you find is that the bugs were actually put in place there on these planets by the government because they wanted to farm them for I think it's called something 710 excrement that they gave, which fuels their spaceships. Which if you flip the number 710 upside down, it is oil. So it is very much a government has screwed over its people in pursuit of oil to fuel. So, but people are still like, no, it's just a game. I was like,
it's just a game. Stop thinking about it.
Yeah, if you want to just not think and not interact with the art you're doing, that's fine. But I don't think you need to be up in arms against people who choose
you're allowed to do it. Yeah.
Is that what's good with you? That the upside down of 710 is oil?
Yeah. That is what's
Have
good.
Have you
is
heard
that,
the good
that,
news about boobies?
Yeah. Look, don't get me started on when I punched that number in and I was like, oh, I got a show. I got to show these kids. Yeah, I guess the what's good with me, and we're going to go into it, but I do want to say it. I do want to make it my what's good, because I do feel it, is that I feel like we, for the first time in a long time, we had a pretty good award show. You know, I think there was its downs, but I think the whole time I was at Demi's house watching, I was at his like Oscar party, and I was there with actually Bria Grant from Reading Glasses, and we kept like looking over at each other, like, is this a good award show? Is it? And like, we even like checked on Twitter, and everyone was having a good time. And I say it because I feel like a lot of movies award shows have had trouble not getting lambasted online with their bits and stuff. And I think everyone kind of had fun with it. I really liked the
Girl, we got a whole section about this.
Yeah.
Don't you take it all up now.
Yeah. I know. I'm stilling so I can say all the stuff before you get a chance. No. But that is my what's good. But yeah, Drea's right. I will wait till we talk about it, but that is my what's good.
We're going to get down really to Inadick and just be crickets.
Yeah, I will say that I was fucked over yet again by Demi. Demi, at his party, he always does a porn parody based on the Best Picture nominees, and the best one wins. He reads them out, and based on the crowd reaction, they go. But what he does is that he first does a read-through, and then he picks them based on the favorites. Then he does a secondary read-through, and I feel like Demi oftentimes makes little comments when he reads them that kind of,
goad the audience.
Affects them. Yeah, because I will say the biggest reaction on the first read was mine, Zone of Entrance, parentheses, the booty hole, and then eventually the winner, even though I do agree with this, was Bustin. Mostly because great pun, and more people need to be talking about Rustin. I think it was painfully overlooked.
Alonzo, how many group chats do you think that Iffy has complained about this in?
At least four, and I think if I'd been there, my entry would have been Fast Wives.
That was a pick. That was a pick, and it was nice. And that did well. So you would have made it to the finals. But Bustin, I think, is just so like crisp and clean.
It does make me feel good.
Bravo!
All right,
bravo.
Well. Today we're mining Dune Month for all its content by discussing the first episode of the 2000 Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, Frank Herbert's Dune. Then we'll have a movie quiz about sci-fi originals, but first it's time for Inadick, our movie news segment where we look at the week's movie news and ask, is this important? Do I care? And now you know what that acronym stands for. So, Alonzo, why don't you kick it off?
So yes, as if you already teased, the Oscars were indeed last Sunday. We're recording the day after Jimmy Kimmel hosted the 96th Academy Awards. It was a show with some very big musical numbers, some surprise comedy moments, a lot of previous winners. And even if all the awards didn't go to our favorite picks, the show itself has gotten more positive reviews than we've seen for an Oscar telecast in quite a while, with the exception of the In Memoriam sequence, and we'll get to that. Is this important? Do you care?
I love it when things work.
Oh yeah. I mean, we all know my general thoughts. How did y'all feel? Did you walk away being like they did a good job?
I mean, I think I want the Oscars to be good. I don't want the Oscars to be like bad and boring.
I'm giving it 3.5 hours of my life. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's like I drove to this party. I bought a bottle of wine. Like, let's have a good Oscars.
I put together a plate of odd hors d'oeuvres on mm-hmm. with a napkin on the side. Yeah.
I was really impressed. I thought that it moved along at a good clip. There were some speeches that really landed. The bits really worked. The John Cena bit, I think, was genius. And I found out later, much ties into the opening of the show where Jimmy brought out all the Teamster IATSE people and talked about the strikes. The John Cena thing ties into a negotiation that the costume designers are currently doing, and their sort of slogan is "You're naked without us." So whether that was planned or whether they're just sharply hopping on board of that train, that too, it turns out to be like a nice little pro-union moment. Yeah, the In Memoriam sequence was a train wreck and badly thought out, and I don't know what they were thinking, not having things on camera where you could read them, so that instead we had to look at like a bunch of dancers and Andrea Bocelli.
The dancers were weird,
Yeah, it was all ill thought out. But no, I thought it went well. I thought there were some, you know, I knew the Mariupol speech was going to be moving. I thought the Jonathan Glazer for, you know, Zone of Interest really sort of said what he needed to say in a cogent way. You know, Cord Jefferson's thing about, hey, let's make more cheaper movies, please, Hollywood. So I think overall it was a success.
I concur. I like that, you know, the flow of it is interesting, and I've worked in many an award show, and so the idea of like how they do the act breaks and the order you do the awards, and you always put the host heavier in the first half because the second half is so dense with commercials. So I think that they did a really good job of structuring, and they should. They've been doing this show for 1,001 years, even if it's different producers every couple of years. I also thought that it's hit or miss sometimes what the live musical performances mm-hmm. would look like. And I thought those were really successful this year.
For sure.
And it's also, they brought back the thing that I love so much. And I know this was a hot button because some people love clips, but as someone who's seen every single one of these motion pictures, I'd much rather have the five former winners come
Agreed.
Out and each say something about the performance, but also it personalizes it, it humanizes it, it gives more opportunity for something that seems real and less like you are all being marketed to. Plus, there's some more beautiful celebrities on stage, and that's kind of why we're watching.
Well, we've all got YouTube. You can watch the clips there, you know.
Yeah.
And shout out to Bill Condon. Sorry, real quick. Bill Condon, who is the producer that innovated that whole thing of bringing out the former winners and that they brought back this year. So, you know.
Yeah.
And it's also like celebrate the nominees, right? Like,
if you've
seen the movie, you've already seen the clip. And if you haven't seen the movie, the clip is not going to give you their performance. So, like, have somebody say something about why they're such a good actor.
That's a great point.
Well, also, I think it adds an element of like celebration. It doesn't feel like this competition. And I think it even made when the people you wanted to win didn't win. I mean, there were like I said, these were pretty stacked categories, but even then, I think having them celebrated even when they didn't win kind of left you feeling like, okay, at least they got their recognition.
Four
their
of you are going to lose, but here's your moment on international television.
It was so great. And I think same thing. I'm right there with you in that everyone touched on it. I definitely think it was funny watching some people dance around actually making a statement. And I think Jonathan Glazer is the best that we got. It is different. Coming from him in the way that he has to say these things because of he is culturally attached to it. And I'll just come out and say it in the general like conversation of it, I feel like there is this idea that in order to talk about the Palestinian genocide, you are rejecting your Jewishness. And I feel like Jonathan Glazer did it in a way where he was trying to explain that in the small time that you have in getting an award, where he's like, yes, there were atrocities. There was October 7th, but using that to justify all this is not the move. And for that, I'm like, yeah, let's go for it.
His also would have been the most noticeable had he said nothing, as his film directly deals
yes,
with.
Yes, exactly. 100%.
It would have been glaring.
It would have. Yeah, truly, Dre. And so I was, you know, like, I was like, yeah, cool. But I do feel like, you know, we have a lot of armchair discourse after the fact with a lot of takes on what people said, a lot of takes on John Cena being naked. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot that Twitter is now the fun police headquarters. And we must now, have a think piece about everything done just to make sure that we've crossed our I's and dotted it.
Well, they have the actual fun police I would like to see in this world, and that's Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
Yes.
And then going this into a bit about Michael Keaton's Batman, and I was like, all right, that is the kind of absurdly not timely. Neither of those references are timely. And
they weren't even
so
in the same movie.
They were not the same Batman.
They were like, they were pitching things and they're like, what if we bring you guys out, but instead of talking about twins, what's something else we could talk about? Or Junior, like, that's the kind of absurdity. Like, you're either in on this, you're not. Keaton's in on it.
It's
up there with the John Mulaney, like, let's talk about Field of Dreams for five minutes for no apparent reason. Going back to Zone of Interest real quick, I was thrilled that it won sound, because that's so much of what makes that movie work is the sound. And I felt like in some years you get those sweeps where like one movie just comes in and takes everything. And so the fact that you had the early evening awards going to Poor Things and not Oppenheimer in a lot of cases, and, you know, screenplay going to American Fiction and not Oppenheimer, made me feel like, oh, we're actually paying attention to this on a category by category level and not just block, you know, balloting the one big movie that we all decided we love this year.
I read that in Zone of Interest, the sound team basically siloed themselves away from the rest of the production to just make like a movie's worth of sound for what's happening outside of the movie. And you're like, if that doesn't win the sound Oscar, that's crazy. So much of
the Zone of Interest also is all these technical innovations.
Yeah, truly.
I was thrilled to see that one. I felt like, again, pretty happy with all of them. Godzilla Minus One, we love so much. Again, talking about the little guys coming through. Although, again,
well, the big guy.
There's whole articles about why they had such a cheap budget, so we won't get into that, but good for them.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because that comes on the heels of a piece that somebody ran about Dune Part 2 being a relatively modestly budgeted production compared to other blockbusters of its ilk, and how the effects are way, way better than those of movies that cost quite a bit more. And so I think we are looking at we're looking down the barrel of a reckoning of like, where's this FX money going? And why is it, how is it that it costs so much? And yet like the FX artists aren't being paid. Like what's, and these movies look like garbage. Like there's a lot going on here and none of it computes.
Yeah.
All around, tight, good messages. I like that we're supporting the unions. I like, you know, Cord Jefferson calling out the mid-budget and all that. Because, it's fun when, you know, things that we have said on this pod all the time is said into a microphone to an audience.
My last take is that everyone who got psyched about I'm Just Ken, which they should, because it was incredible, and when Slash showed up I almost peed myself. I hope all of those people go watch a musical this weekend. Because in fact that is what you enjoyed, and that's a whole genre that's out there.
They do that, you guys.
Yes.
Wow, really?
Get some Busby Berkeley in your world.
I've never seen a trailer where they sing a song, so
Okay, well, I guess on that note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about Frank Herbert's Dune, Episode 1.
Back for another game.
You know it.
What's going on?
Just one more week till Max Fun Drive.
Hard to believe. It's been a heck of a year since the last one. We're now a worker-owned co-op. We raised $50,000 for charity last year.
And we've added a bunch of awesome new shows. But do you think we're ready to do it again?
Absolutely. Lovely new gifts are lined up. The episodes will be amazing. And wait till everyone hears the bonus content.
Yeah, plus they know to go to MaximumFun.org/newsletter, so they're getting all the news. Oh, like that meetup day is on Thursday, March 21st.
Then what's bothering you?
Me? Oh, nothing. We're all set for Max Fun Drive to start on Monday, March 18th. I just didn't want you to see this coming. Check.
What? Hang on.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ifeanyi Adeyemi. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Jeremy Bent,
Alonzo Duralde.
Today's movie was, well, not actually a movie, but it was 90 minutes long, so technically, and is the first of a three-part miniseries that aired on the Sci-Fi Channel in 2000. I just graduated middle school. It was directed by John Harrison and stars Alec Newman and William Hurt. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Frank Herbert's Dune, Episode 1?
Stop me if you've heard this one. This basically is the beginning of Dune, and it takes us all the way to the Harkonnen surprise attack on the Atreides compound on Arrakis. And it pretty much follows the beats you expect, although we get more Emperor's Daughter and no Chani in this one, in part one anyway. I did not see the rest of the miniseries. But this is like watching, have you ever seen those things that people do on YouTube where they recut like Lord of the Rings to look like the opening credits of Xena Warrior Princess?
Yeah.
So this is the like late 90s cheap, bright Dune. And it's, you know, bless their hearts, they're really they're giving it all they got, but man, the budget limitations and the where we were with CGI stuff was not great.
And that's from a man that just had to watch David Lynch's Dune last week.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, believe me. And that's the thing. Like, I'm seeing it after Lynch and after Villeneuve. Like, it really, all of the chintziness just kind of like is spotlit. But like, it's shot by the great Vittorio Storaro, who they must have just like literally tied a hand behind his back, because it looks like any number of overly bright and flat television productions of the period. And, you know, it plays the hits. You know, you get to see the Gum Jabbar. You get to meet, you know, Fade Rotha and Duncan Idaho and stuff. But it's like watching that Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie after you watched like one of the you know, 20th Century Fox versions.
Dune.
Frank Herbert's Dune, Chapter One.
Yeah, I guess you know, we've talked about the Dave Lynch one.
Close personal friend Dave Lynch.
My homie Dave D Lynch is what I call him. But the David Lynch one, we've talked about. You know, the first part of the Dune. Has anyone seen this version before? Before we watched it.
I had, I think, seen a couple minutes of this, because I read Dune, I think, in like 1999 when I was in high school. And then, you know, like a year later, I was probably like home from college, my freshman year of college. And my dad and I were probably like, whoa, Dune. And I think probably we watched like 5 minutes and we're like, man, what else is that? Is something else on?
Is there a hockey tournament on?
Yeah, maybe a local sports thing of some kind.
Or a test pattern.
I have to agree with Alonzo. The clear budget limitations on this is like, it really hurts the whole affair. I had a strong Hercules, the Legendary Journeys feel throughout, where it's just the whole thing. It's obviously there's no shooting on location. It's all sound stages. It's the CGI is pretty rough, especially when they're in the quote-unquote desert, you know. It's not, they're trying, they really are, but it's just not that great.
Well, what I'll say, if I may put in a differing,
oh, beautiful,
I
mean, not, hats,
no, one's not going to say a defense as much, but I will say I do think the scripting of this was a lot more cohesive and understandable than old Dave Lynch's. And if you're looking at a rudimentary way into what are my dramatic conflicts in Dune, what are the key elemental relationships, I did think the setup of all of those, like this one begins with the very first scene, and then we can talk about the thing that annoyed me most, which is the 52-year-old grump ass who played Paul. And I was like, who is this old man playing a petulant teenager, and how long do I gotta watch him?
Oh.
But we come in and we see him being, you know, middle-aged and like petulant. But it kicks off with the scene with the mother superior and her box, and like it moves into those things. And if I was going into this blind, which I'm not, because we've seen 18,000 of these already, but if I was going into it blind, I do think that this laid out the story points of Dune in a much more concise manner. Is that artistic? No, not always.
I will grant you that. As somebody who hasn't read the books, but has now seen like all of these versions, this one at least to me felt like it's setting up who's who and why and the stakes. And even like the David Lynch one, which is so narrated and so exposition heavy off the top with Virginia Madsen just giving it a raw, like you get at least some idea of like why the, you know, why is it a big deal that the Atreides get Arrakis, and why they're waltzing into it, even though it seems like it might be a trap, or all of these things that are going on. Like, I think, yes, it does delineate that in a very cohesive way.
Yeah, here's a couple thoughts. Yeah, I think you're right. I did not like this Paul one bit. I was not on his side. I would say I was on the Harkonnen side watching this at this point. There was that moment where he's like mad at the like witch mother who gives him the Gom Jabbar test for talking to his mom that way, and then when he gets done with it, he yells at his mom for not telling. I was like, well, how are you going to be mad at this?
Are you on?
Yeah,
bud?
Exactly. What's you're the like deal? Talking crazy to mom.
And he's got the voice already, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, that was the other 6 minutes
he's a middle-aged account manager. He's had time to learn it. But he, like, she comes in, and not only he doesn't have any idea who she is, he has zero fear of her, and he's like, I already got this voice. Don't even worry about it. And that actually leads me to the thing that I was, I don't know if I'm thankful for this. This movie laid bare an inherent layer of sexism, which somehow, to this point, had flown over my head. I was like, everything about this, all of Lady Jessica being like, you were, first off, in the whole just like literal millennia of manipulation that was going in by the, is it Bene Gesserit?
Yes.
I never say it right. But that was going in, and they're like, you were supposed to give birth to a daughter. Like, that's how our plan comes to fruition. And she's like, but he wanted a son. I'm like, gross. That's gross. There are so many parts in this version of it that I was like, oh, shit. This text is sexist as hell. And somehow all of the trappings of other Fliberty did not clue me in on that. Like, that. And this one leans into it. This one's like, oh, get into this sexism.
Kwisatz Haderach can't be a chick.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, chicks are the worst. Oh, that's the other thing. Like, it's, again, the same line in all of them. But that scene that in when we talked about old Dave Lynch's with Guy Branum, Guy brought up like the beautiful artistry and clean writing of that first scene with the Mother Superior, and how much it completely just sets up this dynamic, and there's this tension and all of this. And in this scene, it ends, and both of them end in a similar way, but this version of it, like I'm saying, the laying bare, she's like, oh, no girls have ever withstood that kind of pain.
They would never be able
girls
to.
Girls are the worst.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Right? Like, I run a coven of women. The worst, am I right?
Bunch
like,
of losers.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I'm reminded of how much I am appreciating the fact that Villeneuve and his co-writer are digging into the idea of what messianic religion means as a political tool. Because in the Lynch one, and what I'm sensing from this one is like, is he? And then at the end, he is! And whereas in the Villeneuve, it's like, is he going to be the thing that we wrote around him so that he could fit into it? Maybe, if he says yes, you know, which is a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, maybe it's pretty dangerous if he is. So maybe he shouldn't, but they don't talk about that at all in this one. Yeah.
Okay, so Alonso also brought up, and I was, is it Chani? Again, I've seen 80 of these, and I'm like, how do I say that person's name?
Isn't it Chani?
I don't know for sure, but is Chani the, like, servant who is in the
That's house? What I thought.
That's because they really made a moment out of that.
Okay, yeah. I thought maybe she was, but I wasn't sure if that why that would work.
I'm not entirely sure either, but even with that, that's like an aside, and she is just a servant in the house, and you could sort of tell her apart from the other servants, but sort of not. But there are like all these deep romantical scenes with Ur-Yulon. And I was like, what? I was like, did you read this whole book all the way through before you started drafting this? Were you like, okay, there's definitely a romance. Oh, this person's a princess. It's going to be
gotta be her,
right? Yeah. And then like they're going to get to the second episode and be like, ooh, snap, it wasn't with her.
It's also like kind of a big plot point in Dune that it takes a long time to get from planet to planet, and then all of a sudden like the princess is just like there for dinner, and then it's like gotta go. You're like,
well, I thought that was the whole that's what Spice does, was that it folds the space or something.
I I mean, in the book, space is how it makes it possible to navigate space, because otherwise you'd like crash into a planet or something.
And this, of course, brings up the question: what doesn't space do? Right,
yeah. Kind of nothing.
It makes the whole universe function, apparently, in terms of space travel. It turns your eyes blue, and it actually also makes food tastier. So, like, what doesn't it do?
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, and it makes you get a high on it too. Like the Baron Harkonnen, like, has it in a snuff box.
And then they have the spice beer, and you're like, this is a weird interaction of like, don't. And then she like pounds the spice beer, and you're like, it's like supposed to be a cool moment, but I'm like, this is weird.
It would have been great if she'd like slugged down the rest of the beer and then ripped out like a real big burp just to show that she's one of the guys.
Yeah, yeah. She's cool. She's a dumb
girl. She's not a dumb girl. She's a cool guy. So this came out when two of you were children, and then I was, you know, just a little older than Iffy's babysitter. Had anybody seen this? Because when I looked this, I don't remember hearing about this. I didn't see this. And then I looked it up, and it was like, this was still to this day the biggest box or the biggest rating success the Sci-Fi Network ever had. Like, Burger Bar. I was like, what are they talking about?
I had a vague notion that existed, but pretty much the only thing I ever turned to the Sci-Fi Channel for was Mansquito. So I was not one of their more devoted viewers at the time.
I will say the stronger impression that this left on my memory is when I looked it up to be like, who are these actors? The Wikipedia page has the cover of the DVD, and I'm like, I have seen that DVD. Like, I've been in a Best Buy or something, and that cover is familiar.
We have Dune at home.
Yeah. It's like, oh, Dune, huh? And you're like, not buying
I do want to know, like, who the millions of people are that watch this. And did they also take in the, like, did they watch The Lynch? Is anyone doing what we're doing is what I'm saying. And did they probably give themselves longer than a month to do it?
Well, it's worth thinking about the fact that in 2000, like, geek culture was not a cinematic thing yet. Like, the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man had not yet been released.
True. So, like X2 came out that year, right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, X2. And it was like maybe starting a little bit. But, like, it had yet to become, like, a cultural phenomenon. So the idea of, like, making another movie out of Dune when they already made one that failed is like kind of a crazy thing to do.
Yeah. But also, like, sci-fi, the Sci-Fi Network, you know, had its burn as like, it was the home for like
hard
sci-fi show.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what really kind of helped it. Because they had that one show, that was, it's on Amazon now, The Expanse. And like that was their more recent banger. And then they didn't have the money for it. And I guess Bezos liked it so much, he was like, I'll keep it going over here.
At the time, for sure. Like, that was where you would get, that was where you're sort of like, somewhat more cerebral Canadian Star Trek knockoffs all lived, and I could see where like
Farscapes,
you, yes,
what
exactly,
have
and I could see you, with why you would sink some money into this, because it's like the property is beloved. Yeah, the movie didn't work, but you know, you shouldn't remake the hits; you should remake the duds anyway. And we're going to give it this like, what, 6 hours, I guess, total. And so that, you know, feels like we're gonna do justice this time, because, you know, we're not gonna hand out a glossary and rush through it the way, you know, Dave Lynch did. So on paper, I see the point of this, but then you still, the on execution, a sci-fi budget, this is what you get.
Yeah.
You
know? You're so right on the cinematography, because there are some beautiful framing in this. Like, there's camera moves, there's compositions, there's things. And then, like you said, it's like overly lit. I do think that the cinematographer was absolutely not allowed into the color correction process. I do think a lot could have been really cleaned up at that stage. And it is this strange disconnect, because, like I said, the scripting of it really enhances the almost Shakespearean, like, the machinations of court and the power struggles and the family dynamic. Like, there's all of these things that come out, and I think that the actors were, I mean, it's William Hurt. Like, it's people like bringing it to the table, and then they are wearing the Like, they are wearing what I had to wear as a hostess at Chi Chi's. Like, but lamé. Like, just silver and gold. Like, the most ridiculous. Every fabric choice. I was
one,
like, what?
One guy has a hat that I said, make me look like an end cap at Z Cavaricci. You know? There's this pointy stripe thing. Although you can tell the one note that they had from the Lynch version was like, none of the aliens in this movie are going to look like they have herpes. I insist upon this.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
It really, when you compare this to like the Villeneuve version, it's like that version is so... compared to this sci-fi version is so restrained. Like the sci-fi version is so like, how dare you? You know, it's like everyone's being so like they're doing it to the cheap seats at like summer stock, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, Barry Harkonnen should have a mustache to twirl.
Yeah, like,
He's great though. That actor, Ian McNeice.
I mean, he serves it up for sure.
I very much enjoyed his take on this. As, you know, someone who's seen 18 of them.
Yeah, it's an understood the assignment for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And still a little ginger. You know, it's important to me that bad guys are recognized as redheads. And they did still keep a little of that. Oh, my God. And then can we talk about the Fade Raha is played by Matt Keesler.
Yes.
Many people of that era will recognize, but I was like, oh, yeah, you mean the hot guy from Waiting for Guffman?
Exactly.
I hate your ass face.
Like, that casting, when he showed up, I was like, no. Did I fever dream this whole movie into happening? Like, is that Matt Keesler? If you were going to tell me, okay, put together, let's say that sci-fi did an adaptation of Dune in 2000, I'd be like, let me stop you there. Matt Keesler. What do we think?
He had this mid-90s moment with like Waiting for Guffman and this Irish film, I think, called Run of the Country. And then like never quite, you know, the people were not lining up to get in the Matt Keesler business. But by 2000, he's at a point where he's willing to do a Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, but he gets the and Matt Keesler credit.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, he works for the extra bill or the extra titling. Yes.
That's an agent doing his job there. Yeah. Like, I know. It's a sci-fi series, but.
Get a single title card. They're holding it for 3 seconds, and you get either and or with, depending on who the other mainliner is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hell yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess are we gonna go ahead and vote?
I'll vote it.
Yeah. Sure.
The way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being pretty self-explanatory. Who wants to start?
Please, you
don't go at once.
I'm gonna say, especially if you've just, I literally watched this 2 days after I watched Dune Part Two, and for that alone, I'm gonna say stream it because it's very fun to see. Like, oh, they really. Whatever your opinion on the modern Dune films is, they're much better. They're much better than any previous adaptation.
I would say, I kind of agree. Like, I enjoyed this, and I also found it easier to watch than Dave Lynch's, in the sense, like I said, it cooks along. It is made for a lower common denominator. Mm-hmm. Like, it, you know, it's made to be more accessible. It is ridiculous. It has... Again, some of the dumbest green screen choices I've seen in a while.
Very bad.
Also, they keep doing this thing. It's supposed to be the desert. And to give an idea of how wealthy the Atreides are, they're like, so we're going to give them a lot of plants inside, but we're going to make sure they're the cheapest looking IKEA fake plants you've ever seen in your life. So, like, just this very cognitive dissonance going on with the styling at every level. But I do think if you've never watched any Dune... These will cook along, and it's not a bad entry point for, I want to know who the characters are and what the story is. Because if I'm worried about, like, how I can take it, if you saw this, and then you went to the Villeneuve Dunes, and you're like, oh, now I know the backstory, now I know this, oh, world building of cinema. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think I'm going to screen it too. I mean, I stream it rather, because like there is something fascinating about watching such vastly different versions of the same property. And this is almost like watching the high school play version after you've seen the Broadway show. But in that level, it's still kind of fascinating. And yeah, the writing does clarify some things. By the way, speaking of clarification, X-Men 1 was in 2000, X2 was in 2003. Mm. Thank you, producer Marissa. But yeah, I think if you sampled your Davy and your Denis, you know, look at this thing and just be like, huh, I guess that's a way you could do it too, I guess.
We welcome all Dunes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm also stream it because I agree with y'all on that, where like watching all these different versions makes me appreciate the differences. Yeah, definitely not my favorite out the bunch so far, by any means, but I do think it's like was concise and like you said, kind of like keeps you along. I think the I forget the name of it, the killer device that looks like
the
big
hunter seeker or whatever.
Yeah, the hunter seeker that looks like a big
the golden
silver sperm.
Yeah.
It was like just a silver sperm just flying around. And I was like, no one called this out.
The
no one
jizz
was like,
of death.
No one was like, maybe we switch it up. Also, this is one that felt like it looked the least sci-fi. Like this could have been a fantasy for all I was concerned, if it wasn't for the mystical silver jizz that was almost going to kill the Atreides. But yes, all in all, still was a treat. So, maybe our suggestion is watch this after watching other versions of Dune to really appreciate it. You tell us. But for now, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Most of the plants humans eat are technically grass.
Most of the asphalt we drive on is almost a liquid.
The formula of WD-40 is San Diego's greatest secret.
Zippers were invented by a Swedish immigrant love story.
On the podcast Secretly Incredibly Fascinating, we explore this type of amazing stuff.
Stuff about ordinary topics like cabbage and batteries and socks.
Topics you'd never expect to be the title of the podcast. Secretly Incredibly Fascinating.
Find us by searching for the word secretly in your podcast app.
And at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Yosef Uwadiwe. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Jeremy Bent,
Drea Clark,
Marissa Flaxbart is also here.
Yeah.
Hello. Hi, it's me, producer Marissa, and I am here to celebrate the fact that we have watched a sci-fi original. It wasn't a movie, as if we said. It was a miniseries, a TV show. But sci-fi has been the home to many an interesting film over the years. Alonzo alluded to one already. In Mansquito,
which is the one correct answer I have today, so just
I feel like most of their movies are animal portmanteaus. So
yeah,
well, that knowledge may help you in what the quiz that I have for you today, which is, I think, one of these like anybody's game quizzes. Although knowing what Alonzo now has revealed of his interest in Mansquito, I did take Mansquito off the table. But although I guess we've all heard him say that now, so you could have rung in.
Game.
But what I've got here is a list that is partly made up of movies that were either sci-fi original films, like sci-fi produced them, or movies that were direct-to-video that sci-fi bought to broadcast. And then I also have a few others that are nothing, that are, at least they're not movies, they're just things that I made up, and your job is to tell me.
Two Mansquitoes and Alive.
Yeah. Is it? Exactly, that's an excellent title, you know. Is it sci-fi or is it a lie?
That's what it is. Okay, okay.
I just thought of that right now.
Sci-fi or lie-fi.
Lie-fi. Okay, thank you. See?
We're workshopping. We're workshopping.
Workshopping, improving. This is great. This is great. Is everybody ready to get started?
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay. The first title is Kraken, Tentacles of the Deep.
Real.
Real, yeah. Sci-fi. I'm going for real.
That feels sci-fi, yeah.
Or am I supposed to say sci-fi? Sorry. Yeah. I've never sci-fi once
or
done a call.
Or Li-Fi.
Sci-fi.
I mean.
All right. Well, I'll end your anticipation and let you know that, yes, in fact, that was real. It was sci-fi.
Yeah.
How about Ragin' Cajun Redneck Gators?
Li-Fi?
I want that to be real.
I'm gonna go with that's possibly sci-fi.
I'm gonna say lie.
I'm going to say that's real.
Those of you who voted real, you are correct.
Nice.
The movie was also sometimes or possibly later called Alligator Alley.
Why? The
original title.
Not as good.
No.
The sequel to Nightmare in Alley.
Raging Cajun Redneck Gators.
Bradley the Cooper's Redneck great Lobby is very too, sensitive. Though.
That might be it.
The Redneck Lobby.
Bride of Sasquatch.
I'm going to say that's a
sci-fi?
Lie.
That feels like a lie to me.
I'll say lie.
Okay, it is a lie. Man.
That said, would watch.
I did watch that.
Somebody call
that. There
sci-fi.
Are a lot of Sasquatch movies on this list of sci-fi movies.
Dre, I hope you're jotting these down.
Yeah, oh, I just registered that with the U.S. Patent Office.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Shark in Venice.
I know they have a bunch of shark shit. Shark in Venice?
God,
could see, go either way. That's a lie.
I'm saying that's a sci-fi.
I'm going to say that's a lie because I think it would be too expensive to make.
Uh-huh.
This is, in fact, sci-fi.
Wow.
Venice, Italy,
this
or California?
This was not one that...
Yeah. Venice, California.
That's a good question. I think, actually, Venice, Italy, and somebody made this before sci-fi ponied up the money for it, wow. It looks like. Okay. I think that's the history.
Somebody really had a dream.
Yeah. How about Terror in Red Hook?
In Red Hook, Brooklyn? No, I don't think so.
A lie.
Sci-fi.
Alonzo has faith in my made-up answers, but yes, no, that is a lie.
I want
I
these movies to exist. That's all.
Here, I'll tell you the only reason why. Not enough of the middle of the country knows what the fuck Red Hook is.
I know. I was like, they made a horror sci-fi original set where the IKEA is in Brooklyn. I don't think so.
It writes itself.
I thought that was actually a reason why it might work. Yeah, you know, Red Hook sounds a lot more menacing.
It
than
does.
It, actually
true,
yeah.
It does. It true does.
All they wanted was meatballs.
Okay, how about Arachnoquake?
Oh, for sure.
That's a real
sci-fi.
One.
That's got to be real.
If it's not, we're making it.
It is, in fact, sci-fi,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Grizzly Rage.
I think that's
a lie,
fake.
Baby.
You think it's fake? Grizzly Rage? I'll say sci-fi.
Yeah. I'm going to say that's a lie because it doesn't sound sci-fi enough to me.
Oh, yeah, what's sci-fi about sharks?
Grizzly Rage is sci-fi.
No,
but the shark in Venice.
Yeah, that's Rage okay. Didn't sound enough. I like Grizzly Palooza or something.
Yeah. Exactly.
How about Nazis at the center of the earth?
That sounds trauma.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to go lie on this one.
Yeah, that's a lie.
Apparently this is sci-fi. Wow. This is something that at least it aired on the Sci-Fi Network. Nazis at the center of the earth.
That sounds great because they're already getting incinerated from the beginning of them.
Yeah.
It turns out it's about a bunch of corpses.
Party on Werewolf Mountain.
Okay. Lie. Finally, it's finally time.
Party on Werewolf Mountain. I want to be true so badly.
I was going
to
say, because lie. Yeah.
No, I'm going to say that's real.
Nice.
All right. That one is also fake.
It's so good. Marissa, the problem is I want to make yours. Like, I hear them and I'm like, that sounds great.
It sounds like you guys needed a development deal going because Marissa's just got a million of them.
Considering the amount of effort that I put into these fake titles, if this is all it takes to start getting those deals signed, I would love
$7,000. $7,000.
I'm a machine.
I hope there's a sci-fi exec listening to this just going,
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I actually might have a hookup, come to think of it. How about just a few more? Why don't we talk about Battle Dogs?
Battle Dogs.
Ooh.
Sure.
That's got to be real.
I'm going to say lie.
I'll say sci-fi.
God, you're so confident.
It is sci-fi.
Wow.
I don't know what it is.
Too simple.
I wish I could tell you.
Yeah.
It's Battle Dogs. I don't know what else you need.
Yeah.
How about Haunted High School?
Lie.
Yeah, that was not my most inspired.
it made me think of Rock and Roll High School with the Ramones.
Right.
Rock and Roll High School.
Sci-fi, I don't think of them as ghosts as much as, you know, megalodons or whatever.
They do have some ghost titles. Okay.
Marissa, I still wanted Haunted High School to be real.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I'll tell you, Alonzo, I'm pretty sure they had a ghost shark at one point.
Oh, they must have.
Yeah.
How about two lava, two lantula?
Sci-fi.
Please be real.
Sci-fi, yeah.
That's I'm so going to say that's a lie.
This apparently is a sequel to a movie called Lava Lantula.
God bless.
A real one.
Thrilled.
The Omega Principle.
That sounds like a best-selling novel from the 1973.
I was going to say, I'm going to say a lie just because it seems like it's from another decade.
Yeah, I'm going to say lie.
Well, that one was a lie, but also The Omega Principle is the name of a book about like fish oil capsules that I think came out somewhat recently, like a nonfiction book.
Okay.
Five-headed shark attack.
Ooh. Oh, that's real.
Yeah, that's got to be real, yeah, right?
Sure. Sci-fi.
Just on the law of patterns, you know? Of course, the five-headed shark attack is a follow-up to two-headed shark attack, three-headed shark attack.
I pray, yeah. Every installment, another head.
Well, you guys did great at this quiz. I was not good enough to stump you with my fake titles.
You were too good. Your titles were good. Can I say my favorite sci-fi movie title that I remember?
Sure.
Like, obviously, Sharknado was the big thing, so they got very into the port. My favorite one was Piranaconda, because it just flows. Piranaconda.
Yes.
Like, what else are you doing with your time but making that?
I pulled that one from my list and then I didn't read it. But that should have been on the quiz and you would have really aced it. Oh, man. The last thing I'll say is that Battle Dogs is a 2013 American television film featuring Dennis Haysbert,
wow,
Ernie Hudson, and Bill Duke. And it is about a strange werewolf virus that threatens to decimate New York and then the world.
Man, Haysbert really
first Red Hook, and then the
fell
world.
Off after 24. I guess.
Yeah,
he was like, I got to book some gigs.
Allstate only pays so much. You know?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, excellent job, one and all.
Thank you, Marissa.
Will we ever cover any of those movies on the show? Time will tell.
Hey, there we go.
That was that. This was this. Now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
Oh, me. I'm very excited about this. So my favorite documentary of last year, which swept the Critics Awards and was completely ignored by the Academy and did not get shortlisted, is Frederick Wiseman's 4-hour French restaurant behind-the-scenes look called Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gros. It is just not to go with all of the obvious metaphors here, but it is delicious. It is just, it is so granular and takes you so in deep in how these dishes are put together, how these restaurants are run. And Wiseman, you know, is one of our greatest living documentarians. He doesn't use music. He doesn't interview people. He doesn't have like on-screen kind of chyrons explaining things. He's super fly on the wall. He does long takes. He lets you take it all in. You sit in on the meetings. You sit back and you watch the chefs do their thing. You see the diners. You get the whole world of these restaurants and why they're like museums of food. Anyway, it is streaming all month on PBS.org, and it is airing on PBS next week on March 22nd at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. So DVR it. Tape it, whatever it is, if you need to give yourself, you know, little 20-minute chunks of the movie to get you through your day and not do all 4 hours at once, or do all 4 hours at once. It'll keep you interested. Anyway, it's an extraordinary movie, and it got some release in U.S. theaters, but I know a lot of people still haven't had a chance to see it yet, so I'm thrilled that PBS is making it available to everybody. So, Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gros.
I will say that Alonzo recommended this to me earlier, and I did watch all 4 hours of it, and he was totally right. You should take it in. And it is good in smaller. It's bite-sized pieces as well
as
a huge main dish. And another reminder, Frederick Wiseman, 94 years of age.
Yeah,
making four-hour documentaries.
It's his 44th feature.
Yeah. What are you doing? Who cares about how many hours in a day Beyonce has? How many hours in a day does Frederick Wiseman have?
Well, in fairness, he's lived twice as long as I have, so
that's fair.
He's had more time.
He should have a little more on his.
So you've only made 22 documentaries.
Yeah, I've only made 22 feature documentaries.
Fair. I have a movie that's totally different from a Frederick Wiseman documentary, but in the vein of looking at sci-fi and an underappreciated gem, and also in honor of brand new best award-winning actor Cillian Murphy, 2007 Sunshine by Danny Boyle, a movie that I love so much and revisited recently. It's like a small crew, and the whole crew, bangers: Cillian Murphy, Michelle Yeoh, Cliff Curtis, Chris Evans, Rose Byrne, Benedict Wong. It's so good. They're on a flight across space to like set fire to the sun, basically, which sounds stupid, but you know, that's what it is. And then interpersonal things happen and space things happen. And it's Danny Boyle, who's so good at like character driven things. It's written by him and Alex Garland. Like, it's choice sci-fi. I don't know why it didn't have more of an imprint when it did, but I think it's great. You can rent it just about anywhere.
That is on my list of movies that I want to see in a theater for the first time.
Oh, like, that'd be
great. I've still never seen it, but I've always been told that it's when you've really got to just... So I'm waiting. And it's like, it's Los Angeles. At some point, someone's going to show it.
I saw it in the theater and it was fantastic. If that's probably never coming to you, feel free to just get yourself a friend with an iffy size screen and sit real close to it.
Yeah, baby. Yeah. You won't have to sit close to it. It's a nice, firm, large screen, you know. Gonna just be on there for you.
He
to means enjoy.
He does have a screen. I just want to clear up all of what sounds like filthy double entendre here.
Look, you know, wherever your mind chooses to take you, Drea, that's on you.
I can pivot to a different film if you've already done this. But if you've already done this on the show, I can choose a different one. The winner for Best Foreign Film is, of course, Zone of Interest, which is an excellent choice. Highly recommend that movie. But also nominated, and I don't know if as many people saw it, but it is excellent, is Society of the Snow.
So good.
Which is a Spanish film that recounts the crash of an airplane in South America in the Andes Mountains. And they actually already made a movie of this called Alive. Two movies.
there was a fly by night movie called Survive that was made in Mexico.
Did not catch Survive.
And Alan Carr and Robert Stigwood bought it for cheap, dubbed it into English, and released it in the U.S. while the book was still hot. And then Alive came out in the 90s?
Yeah, because Ethan Hawke is in it.
Yeah.
And you're just like, so Society of the Snow is, it's actual Hispanic people playing the, you know, the roles, which maybe makes more sense. Yeah, well, what a shock. And but it is also, the script is based on the book written by a man who was childhood friends with the people who actually survived this and interviewed them much later in life. So the script is unbelievably good for Society of the Snow, which a movie that is mostly them dying in this crash in the mountains, but it is a phenomenally good film, beautifully shot, incredible makeups and effects as these people sort of start to sort of wither away in the mountains, but ultimately a movie about the triumph of the human spirit and what it really means to not give up and have a will to live, to truly survive against any possible odds. It really blew my mind how good it was and how little I had heard about it.
It's pretty fantastic. It's J.A. Bayona who made it, who did The Orphanage and The Impossible, Monster Calls. And it's actually an interesting hybrid of the sort of horror and drama. And I agree on the script. It's all of these people and that dives into the ones you don't expect in interesting ways. Solid choice. Good job, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Yes. With me, I'm going to just keep it simple. It came out last weekend, so if you didn't see it, go see it. I think it was a staff pick last week now that I said it, but I'm going to do it again because I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn. If it's good, we're going to do it again. Love Lies Bleeding. Go out and see it. Rose Glass, shout out to you. Drea said that if you cast me in your next film, she will make sure you get that Spirit Award. She said that to me, so I'm communicating it to you. So please, let's make some.
That That, of course, is not how Spirit Awards work. Sorry. Oh,
look, we all know. They all go into a room. They kneel down. Andrea sits upon her throne.
Andrea speaks to them in the voice.
Give them the voice.
Put your hand in this box.
Vote for Iffy.
Pain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's all we have for today. Thank you to Jeremy Bent.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell the listeners where they can hear more of you and where they can find you.
Well, you don't have to go far. You can stay right here on the Maximum Fun Network and find my show, Eurovangelist. That's me. That's Oscar Montoya and Dimitri Pompei telling you everything you need to know about the Eurovision Song Contest. But don't just take my word for it. We were shouted out by none less than Glenn Weldon of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour last week, who said that we are enthusiasts enthusing with sincerity, which I think is a pretty good description of how we feel about Eurovision. Yeah. We've got an episode coming out very soon about the national finals of Portugal's Festival de Canção and Sweden's Melody Festivalen. So please enjoy and be ready for the Eurovision finals in May.
Nice.
Fun show.
Yes, indeed. Dre and Alonza, thank you for another wonderful show. It's always good to see you, hang with you. And we'll have to do it soon. I'm going to try and see this, or I'm not trying to. I'm planning to go see Dune in 4DX. I need seats.
Blow that sand right in your face.
How much Muad'Dib can you take?
Oh, we're going to find out. We're about to find out. And also thank you to our listeners for listening. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, you can send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org or find us on any of our social media channels. All those links are in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune. And it'll be the start of Max Fun Drive. So be sure to tune in so you can hear all about the fun rewards and goals we've got for new and upgrading Max Fun members. Our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is also wonderful. Her name is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.